This is Watchin' Like Bible School 2016. This is the session by Brother Mark O'Grady on the theme Solomon and His Cabinet. This is class number one, Beloved of Yah, and the reading was taken from 1 Chronicles chapter 22, verses 1 to 6. Brother Mark.
Thank you, Brother James, and good evening, brothers and sisters and young people. Well, we're going to begin our journey this evening by coming to meet the man himself, a man of destiny, born for a task. We looked briefly last night at these words, very familiar words from the second book of Samuel, the great covenant of promise that was made to David, when Yahweh said, "When thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom, and he shall build an house for my name." So we know that David was told explicitly that it would be his son who was going to build that great house. It's interesting, you know, the record in 2 Samuel chapter 7, the great covenant to David, doesn't record everything that was said by God on that particular occasion. And in fact, the equivalent record in the book of Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 17, doesn't tell the full story either. And there's a rather astonishing addition which is put into the record here in 1 Chronicles 22, where David refers back later in life to what God had told him on that particular occasion. So we're going to pick up the record in verse 6. He called for Solomon his son and charged him to build an house for Yahweh God of Israel. And David said to Solomon, "My son, as for me, it was in mine house to build, in my mind, to build an house unto the name of Yahweh my God. But the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Thou hast shed blood abundantly and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my son, my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies round about, for his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his day." So he's told that a son was going to be born to him, and he's even told the name of his son. That boy is going to be called Solomon. Now, you know what's astounding about that? It means that in 2 Samuel chapter 12, when David comforts Bathsheba and she bears a son, it was no accident that they called him Solomon. It wasn't just a name whose sound or meaning they liked. It was preordained by God. But you know what's even more remarkable? That instruction to David took place years before the incident with Bathsheba. And he already knew what the name of that son was going to be called. Now, how's that for predestination? How did David and Bathsheba know that this particular son was to be the son that was called Solomon? We don't know, but David clearly did. And what that shows us, brothers and sisters, is that Solomon was absolutely a man of destiny. Now, while we're here in 1 Chronicles 22, let's just note some words in verses 8 and 9, which we're going to draw upon a little bit later this evening. Well, actually, verse 9. "Behold, a son shall be born to thee, who shall be a man of rest." That's a contrast with David in the previous verse, who was a man of war. He's going to be a man of rest, and I will give him rest from all his enemies round about. Now, we're given an insight here as to why David was not allowed to build that house for God. There was a symbolic pattern or type that was to be established. And David, as a man of war, was not appropriate to use in that type. This house had to be constructed by a man of rest. He's going to be a man of rest. It's an interesting title, that, isn't it? A man of rest. It's the Hebrew word menuha. It's actually the same word that comes up in the book of Numbers. In relation to the ark and the wanderings of Israel, they departed from the Mount of Yahweh 3 days' journey,
And the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh went before them in the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. Numbers 10, verse 33. And it's exactly that same word, rest. He is a man of rest or a resting place. Again, it comes up in a similar context. In Psalm 132 and verse 8, arise, O Yahweh, into thy rest, and it's the same word, thou and the ark of thy strength. Now just tuck those two passages away in the back of your mind because we're going to need them a little bit later on. It's this Hebrew word, menuhah. And he's also described there as being a man of peace, and so he's called Solomon, which of course is the equivalent of the Hebrew word shalom, the idea of peace. So when this little child is finally born in 2 Samuel chapter 12, the record says that Yahweh loved him. Now that's when he was an infant. It was before he had ever had the opportunity to do anything. Yahweh looked at that little child and he said, I love that child. And so he sent Nathan the prophet, who came in and gave him a second name, Jedidiah, beloved of Yahweh. So can you sense the import of this particular child? He's given two names by the Almighty. He's loved of Yahweh. He's been preordained and his name was many years in advance. What an extraordinary and very auspicious start in life. So right from those early scenes, we understand that this man was going to be a very special person. But of course, it wasn't just God who loved him. We're told in the book of Proverbs, we won't turn it up, but Proverbs 4 verse 3, Solomon speaking said, I was my father's son, tender and only in the sight of my mother. Or as Rotherham renders that, for a son I became to my father, tender and most precious in the sight of my mother. So these two, David and Bathsheba, knew that this boy was different. He was very precious in their eyes. And so they lavished upon him all the love and the teaching and the wisdom that they could possibly convey to this little child. And so Solomon continues in that book of Proverbs. He says, speaking of his father, so he taught me. And he said to me, let thy heart lay hold of my words. Keep my commandments and live. Can you imagine David saying these words to his son? Lay hold on my words. Keep my commandments, son, and live. Hear, my son, and receive my sayings, and they will multiply thee the years of thy life. And so David and Bathsheba very carefully nurtured the development of this young child. Actually, his mother seems to have taken a rather special role in the bringing up of Solomon. It appears that they had a very close, a very strong relationship. So much so that others observed and commented on the power of that relationship. You may recall the incident of Adonijah. He tried to make use of that relationship himself later on. When he said to Bathsheba, oh, can you go and ask for this from Solomon? He will not say no to you, was Adonijah's observation about the influence that Bathsheba could have on her chosen boy. We find in particular that she took great interest in instilling into him the moral values of a great king. Now, how can we say that? Well, I'd like you to come with me to the end of the book of Proverbs, the record of the words spoken to King Lemuel by his mother. Now, of course, the question is, well, who is King Lemuel? And it literally means the king for God. And it seems generally agreed that this is actually words of Solomon himself, that the king for God is a title. The Jewish rabbis also believe that as well. And here it is at the end of the book of Proverbs, put together by Solomon, written by Solomon, and it's the advice that the king for God received from his mother. Verse 1, the words of King Lemuel, the prophecy that his mother taught him. What, my son? What, the son of my womb, and what, the son of my vows? And she carries on to give him some specific wisdom. She gives him the advice to avoid strong drink and the advice to not give his strength to women, two things which it would have been good for him to remember later in life. But then in verse 8, she also says to this child, open thy mouth for the dumb in the cause of all such as are appointed to destruction. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and the needy. And it's interesting, you know, you can't help but notice as you go through the book of Proverbs and the book of Ecclesiastes that the theme of caring for the poor and protecting the oppressed is very rich and prevalent all the way through those two books. So, for example, Proverbs 29 and verse 14, we read, "The king that faithfully judgeth the poor, his throne shall be established forever." Or Proverbs 14, verse 31, "He that oppresseth the poor reproacheth his maker, but he that honoureth him hath mercy on the poor." And it's interesting to see how this advice from Bathsheba seems to have been picked up by her son and applied by him in the words of wisdom, which we find in the book of Proverbs. What it tells us, mothers, is that you should never underestimate the power of your influence on your children. And mothers with sons, never underestimate the impact that you have on the development of your sons. Right from a little age, as you're teaching them those basic principles of life, right through into their preteen years and their adolescence, and as a young man, the words of a wise mother are extremely powerful. And it would appear that that was the case with Solomon himself. Now, whilst we're speaking about what Bathsheba contributed to Solomon, we know, of course, that Solomon was noted for his extraordinary wisdom because of the way that God blessed him with this exceptional wisdom. But did you know that it was also in his genes? Does anybody know who Bathsheba's grandfather was? Ahithophel. And how's Ahithophel described in Scripture? 2 Samuel 16, verse 23, "And the counsel of Ahithophel, which he counseled in those days, was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel." And not only that, you know what her father was? Does anybody know? He was one of the 30 mighty men of David. So by the time you take Ahithophel, one of David's mighty men on Bathsheba's side, and on David's side, well, we've got the great giant slayer and the sweet psalmist of Israel. What an explosive power pack of DNA. So an extraordinary heritage that this young man had on both sides of the family. All right, well, so much for Bathsheba. What about this young man's father? Well, we know, of course, in the book of Proverbs about the teaching that he received from his father. But, you know, there is one particular theme, one special topic which he ingrained in his son's consciousness. And that was the building of the house of God. Now, we know that earlier in his reign, David wanted to build the house for the ark. He said, well, how can the ark of God live in a tent of curtains whilst I live in my own house? He said, look, this is not right. I'm going to build a place for his honour. And God stopped him. He said, no, I never asked you to. You are a man of blood. I want a man of rest to build me that house. It's going to be your son, Solomon. But David was utterly consumed by the thoughts of that house. So he starts avidly and eagerly preparing all the materials that were going to be used. He dedicated his life to that work. In fact, he saw the building of that house as being the great responsibility of his dynasty. That one of the greatest marks of success that they could have would be the building of that house. So he looked at Solomon and he said, you're not just my son. You are the appointed house builder, my son. And we're going to spend a little bit of time now just building up a profile or an impression of how important that theme was to David. And we're going to find that it's a sentiment that just permeates the record of the last part of David's life. Because right from birth, Solomon was predestined to be the builder of that house. And as far as David was concerned, that's what his son was born to do. Now we're going to draw particularly tonight from the book of Chronicles. Does anybody know why that is, by the way? An interesting thing of the book of Chronicles, it has a particular theme around the building of the house of God and the establishment of the courses of the priests and all the arrangements for running and maintaining the operations of the house of God. the order and the establishment of worship. And that actually flows right through both 1st and 2nd Chronicles as well. Now, out of interest, it's interesting, and I guess Bernard will talk about this in more detail. I'm looking forward to what he covers in that night. But it's suggested that the book was put together by Ezra, and particularly the later sections of it were written. I'm just going to pause there for a moment. Brother Skip, am I doing something that I shouldn't be? Okay, excellent. It's not a Kiwi accent or something like that. Good. Okay, well, I'm going to push on. And sorry, brothers and sisters, you're going to have to put up with the fact that every now and again it sounds like I'm squeaking. Okay, so if we think about the days of Ezra, what did they do? They were returning to build the house of God. So it's no wonder that we find this book that he compiled has that as one of its key themes. In fact, the second book of Chronicles finishes with Cyrus and the decree to return to build the house of God. So it's not surprising we're going to draw on 1st of Chronicles quite extensively this evening. So let's go back to 1st of Chronicles 22, and let's pick up in verse 1. Then David said, "This is the house of Yahweh God, and this is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel." What is? Well, there's a context here, isn't there? Of course, we know that in the original there are no chapter divisions, and so the chapter division between 21 and 22 is an artificial construct. So David's making a statement that flows uninterrupted on from what's just been happening in chapter 21. Now, in chapter 21, we have the incident of the angel with the drawn sword after David had numbered Israel. When he saw the angel about to destroy the city of Jerusalem, and Yahweh intervened, and David stopped and offered the offerings there in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. So in verse 26, we find that David built there an altar unto Yahweh and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. He called upon Yahweh, and Yahweh answered him from heaven by fire upon the altar of burnt offering. Chapter 22, verse 1 flows on from chapter 21 and verse 28. Now I'm going to say that again because it's quite critical here. Chapter 22 verse 1 follows directly on from chapter 21 and verse 28. That's because verses 29 and 30 are in parenthesis. So let's read it again. Verse 28 of chapter 21. At that time, when David saw that Yahweh had answered him in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, then he sacrificed there. Then David said, "This is the house of Yahweh God, and this is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel." He's saying, this is where the house is to be. There's a stake in the ground. This is a point here of revelation. This is the spot. This is where the altar is going to be based. So let's go back now, and we're going to read through the record, and we're going to delete the chapter division. And I want you to listen to what the words of Scripture are saying and see if you can pick up the contrast that's being painted here for us. Verse 28. At that time when David saw that Yahweh had answered him in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, then he sacrificed there, for the tabernacle of Yahweh, which Moses made in the wilderness, and the altar of the burnt offering were at that season in the high place at Gibeon, but David could not go before it to inquire of God. For he was afraid because of the sword of the angel of Yahweh. And David said, "This is the house of Yahweh Elohim. This is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel." Can you sense the contrast which is being painted by the record here between these two houses, the tabernacle of Moses on one hand and this new house which is going to be built in the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite? Two houses and two altars. Now, one of those, David was too scared to go before because of his sin, because of the angel and the drawn sword. "I can't inquire of God there. It's too dangerous." And the other house has the sword sheathed in verse 27. Yahweh commanded the angel. He put up his sword again into the sheath thereof. "The sword is sheathed. Now stay your hand," was the instruction to that angel beforehand.
Now that's interesting. Can you hear an echo? He said, I can't go to that place to inquire of Yahweh because of the angel with the drawn sword. What does that remind us of? Any suggestions? Eden, the Garden of Eden, Genesis 3, the cherubim and the flaming sword, which stopped them from going to the tree of life. But what he has now is a way of absolute contrast. This is the place where the angel has a sword which is sheathed. And there's a contrast being painted here between these two houses and these two altars. The former is associated with the tabernacle of Moses and the brazen altar, and the latter is associated with a new place, a new house, and the new altar that David has just built. Now, it's not our topic tonight, but what we find is that second one is very closely associated with the theme of the tabernacle of David and the sure mercies of David, which become a beautiful theme which runs through Scripture, through the small prophets, minor prophets, and on into the life of the Lord Jesus Christ himself. But for us, there's this one little passage which helps us understand what's being conveyed, and that's Hebrews 13, verse 10. We have an altar whereof they have no right to eat, which serve the tabernacle. And you see the contrast that's being painted between those two ways. Now, David got that. He understood the point. And it galvanized him into action. So when we go back now to 1 Chronicles 22, the very next verse, verse 2, David commanded to gather together the strangers that were in the land of Israel, masons to hew stones. Verse 3, he prepared iron in abundance, brass without weight. Verse 4, the cedar trees in abundance. And now we have a picture of feverish activity as David starts to gather with all his energy materials for this new house. You can sense a hive of activity and a passionate commitment to preparing for this new house that's going to be built. And then he stops and he turns his attention to look at his boy. And what does he see? He sees a young lad, probably still in his teens. And verse 5, David said, Solomon, my son, is young and tender. So he shouldered as much of the preparation as he possibly could. He said, I'm going to make preparation for it, because he knew that his personal time was running out. Now we know that, because in verse 5 he said at the end of the verse, I will therefore make preparation for it. So David prepared abundantly before his death. And his demise was hanging there like an inevitability, and it was fast approaching, and he knew it. And he turns to look at his young boy, and what did he see? A young and tender boy upon whom this entire process was to devolve. So how can he convey to this young lad the extraordinary responsibility that he's going to carry to build this house for God? This solemn duty, a commitment to continue the work begun, to finish the house which David's heart was so bound up in, so that after David's death, the work would not fail. And you can sense the intensity and the import that comes into the record as we see what happens next. So in verse 6, David calls for Solomon, and he charges him to build the house for Yahweh. It's the word savar, and it means to command. And you can picture the scene, can't you? Oops, I'm just going to go back. Okay. And you can picture the scene as this old man takes his young son aside and he solemnly adjures him to build this house. Brothers and sisters, if you look around the hall and spot the older brothers and sisters here, and you go and ask them what they earnestly wish to see in ecclesial life today, what will it be? An earnest, passionate desire to see younger generations coming through with a commitment to continue to build the house of God. This is a story about the next generation needing to shoulder responsibility to carry on the work of building the house of God. And this old man's hopes and aspirations are so intensely bound up in the need for his son to fulfill that responsibility. And so we look at the record from verse 7. My son, as for me, it was in my mind to build an house unto the name of Yahweh my God. And he carries on in those next few verses. Solomon, you know where I'm coming from. You know my history, son. You know what God said to me, that I couldn't build it. And you know that he promised me a son who would. Now, my son, and look at the words of verse 11. Now, my son, Yahweh be with thee, and prosper thou, and build the house of Yahweh thy God, as he hath said of thee. Can you hear the intensity and the eagerness of this old man's voice as he said, Solomon, Solomon, know that Yahweh will prosper you. Go and build the house that he said you would build for me. And he gave that command to his son. Now, this man had been king of the nation for 40 years. For 40 years, he had labored with that people. And he'd wanted to bring them to what was described in verse 9 as being a state of rest and peace. And his greatest desire was to finish that work by building the house of God so that God could dwell amongst his people at rest. All his life, he'd been gathering materials. Every campaign that he waged, he put spoils aside for that particular work. But he wasn't allowed to do it. The privilege was not to be his. Instead, the task was to be passed on to a younger man to finish the job. Sorry, David. As a man of warfare and bloodshed, you break the type. And the story that's being told here, the parable being portrayed, cannot be completed to you. By you. It needs to be passed on to a younger man. Now, brothers and sisters, can you hear the echo? What does that remind you of? For 40 years, he had been working with these people. He had a heartfelt desire that he was unable to accomplish because he broke the type. What's the echo? Moses and Joshua. And it's absolutely extraordinary, brothers and sisters, to find that this is the story of Moses all over again. So back in Moses' day, what did Moses do? Well, he called across Joshua and he gave Joshua a charge, just like David did to Solomon. And what was the charge? Deuteronomy 31, verse 7 and 8. We're going to read this, and I want you to see if you can just remember the phrases and the words which we come across here. Moses called unto Joshua and said unto him in the sight of all Israel, Be strong and of a good courage. Thou must go with this people unto the land which Yahweh hath sworn unto their fathers to give them. Thou shalt cause them to inherit it. Yahweh it is, he that doth goeth before thee. He will be with thee. He will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. And the words were carried on by Yahweh to Joshua in Joshua chapter 1, verses 5 to 9. As I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. I will not fail thee, nor forsake thee. Be strong and of a good courage. Verse 7, be thou strong and very courageous. Observe to do according to the law of Moses. Turn not from it to the right hand or left, that thou mayest prosper whithersoever thou goest. Have not I commanded thee, be strong and of a good courage? Be not afraid, be not dismayed, for Yahweh thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. Now with those words ringing in our ears, let's turn our attention back to 1 Chronicles 22 and have a look at what David says to Solomon. Verse 11, Now my son, Yahweh be with thee, and prosper thou, and build the house of Yahweh thy God, as he hath said of thee. Verse 13, Thou shalt prosper if thou take heed to fulfill the statutes of Moses. Be strong and of a good courage. Dread not, nor be dismayed. What have we got? Word for very word, the expressions which Moses passed on to Joshua. All right, well, let's go across now to chapter 28, David's last words to Israel, and have a look at verse 20. The context again is David speaking to Solomon, And David says to Solomon, his son, "Be strong and of good courage. Do it. Fear not, nor be dismayed, for Yahweh Elohim will be with thee. He will not fail thee, nor forsake thee, until thou hast finished all the work for the service of the house of Yahweh." Now, at this point, brothers and sisters, we don't need to be a genius to see the link that the record is giving us between the charge that was placed by Moses upon Joshua and the charge which David gave to Solomon, his son, to undertake the building. And what does it tell us? It tells us that Solomon's responsibility to build that house is directly related to Joshua's responsibility to bring the children of Israel over to rest in the land of Israel. If you think about the symbology of the completion of both of those tasks, they actually both represent the completion of God's work with his people. The finishing of the building of the house of all ages is a symbol of the finishing of immortality as the saints come together in the kingdom. And Joshua bringing the people over the river into the land to dwell is a symbol of the saints being brought in into immortality and the inheritance. But you know, David saw even more than that. What David saw in the work of King Solomon was the completion of the journey of Joshua. The wanderings of the ark and the journeyings of Israel were inextricably linked together. And until the ark was at rest with Yahweh dwelling amongst his people, there could be no permanent rest for Israel. Now, Joshua had brought the people into the land, but now, hundreds of years later, the ark is still not at rest. It went to Gilgal. It went to Shiloh. It got taken captive by the Philistines. It came back. It got lost. David made diligent search for it, it says in the Psalms. And when he found it, he brought it up to the city of Jerusalem. And David saw the purpose of Yahweh dwelling amongst his people would be fulfilled when the ark was at rest. That's what was symbolized, and that's why David was so intense about wanting to get this house built for the ark to dwell amongst Israel. And we can see why it was that David was so earnest to find the ark and to build that house. You know, when David totally transformed the courses of the priests and the Levites, set out all the arrangements for the worship in that house, he understood that it was the beginning of a new era in Israel's history. We won't turn it up, but in chapter 23 and verse 26, he refers to the Levites and the courses of the Levites as no more carrying burdens. And in fact, does anybody know what the very last thing was that they did after Solomon built the house and they put all the furniture into the house? What was the very last thing they did before they withdrew from the house and the glory of Yahweh filled that temple? Does anybody know? The very last thing, you're absolutely right, was they pulled the staves out of the ark, the staves which were used for carrying it. What a hugely symbolic gesture. 2 Chronicles 5 verse 9, "And they drew out the staves, and the heads of the staves could be seen out of the ark in front of the shrine, although they could not be seen on the outside. And it came to pass that they have remained there unto this day." What a magnificent symbol, brothers and sisters, a statement of the fact that the wandering of the ark had finally ceased as it dwelt in the house of God's glory. You know what David hoped? He hoped that was going to bring about the establishment of God's kingdom on earth forever. And that's what he wanted for his son. And he brought his son up with that destiny in mind. Now, not only did he give the charge to his son, but have a look at chapter 22 and verse 17, because having passed the charge to his son, he then gathers the princes, and he commands them in verse 17 to help Solomon, his son, and he tells them to help him to build the temple, build the sanctuary of Yahweh, and to bring the Ark of the Covenant of Yahweh into that house in verse 19. So his command to the elders and to the princes was to help Solomon in the building of that particular house.
So sometime later, chapter 23 and verse 1, David's now old and full of days, and he makes Solomon his son king over Israel. Now, aren't those simple little words? Such a lovely little picture. Having finished all the charges, now it gets to the stage where David's old. And so he happily brings Solomon in, and they make Solomon his son king over Israel. Leave your hand there. Turn over to chapter 29. Verse 22. They did eat, they drank before Yahweh on that day with great gladness, and they made Solomon the son of David king the second time. What's that all about? What's happening here? So what we read in chapter 23 was the first crowning of Solomon, and now in chapter 29 we have the second, and then the penny drops. Those simple little words in chapter 23 in verse 1, that they made Solomon his son king over Israel, that is a reference to the crisis of 1 Kings chapter 1, the day when Solomon was hastily made king in the face of the rebellion of Adonijah. Now that happened after the incident of the angel and the sword. It's recorded after the preparations and discussions of chapter 22. It's after David had given Solomon the charge to build the house. It's after David has given the charge to the princes to help Solomon build that house. In other words, brothers and sisters, the nation knew that Solomon was appointed to become king and build that house. In fact, we're told later that David had sworn an oath that Solomon would sit on the throne and do that. Bathsheba refers to the oath. Nathan refers to the oath. The nation understood that Solomon was appointed and he was going to reign and build Yahweh's house. Now, after that public declaration, David became ill. He retired to his bedroom. And we read in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5, that then Adonijah the son of Haggith exalted himself, saying, I will be king. It says in verse 7 that he conferred, great word, he conferred with Joab and Abiathar the priest, and they, following Adonijah, helped him. In verse 9 of that chapter, we're told that the brethren, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants, were there. In verse 25 of that chapter, it says the captains of the host were there. And brothers and sisters and young people, that was after David had charged the princes of Israel to help Solomon to build his house. So this is not opportunism just because David was unwell and had left a vacuum and some lack of clarity as to what was happening with his kingdom. This was utter and deliberate rebellion. This was treason in every sense of the word. They knew that Solomon had been appointed to that role. They knew the princes of Israel had been spoken to by David, and they chose to crown somebody else. Absolute treason in the house of Israel. And now what I'd like us to do is put ourselves in the shoes of Solomon. He's probably in his late teens. In his own words, 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 7, he felt he was, I am but a little child. He's desperate to have wisdom from God to help him manage this so great a people. And here it appeared that his reign would be over even before it had begun, as would be his life. Now, of course, in ancient times, accession to the throne was never a straightforward matter. An ugly thing of human nature, people aspire to power. And profane history testifies, doesn't it, as to what happens when a powerful king dies and a vacuum ensues. Now, most of Solomon's support base was gone. Just look at what was arrayed against him. The royal family has deserted him. The king's sons have gone with Adonijah. The tribe, which was the royal family's power base, the tribe of Judah, had deserted him. The men of Judah and the king's servants had gone with Adonijah. The religious establishment headed by Abiathar, the high priest of Israel, had abandoned him. And most alarming of all, the army had gone over to the other side, including Joab and the captains of the army. From a human point of view, he was absolutely doomed. Without the support of the religious establishment, the royal family, the local tribe, and the military, he's finished. So what was he to do? Now, David knew, old, enfeebled he might be, he had a core of faith and he had nerves of steel. And so he speaks, 1 Kings 1, verse 29 and 30, "As Yahweh liveth, that hath redeemed my soul out of every distress, Solomon will reign today." And in a lightning fast, preemptive strike, he installed Solomon on the throne. Now just imagine being the young man. I don't know, perhaps he's in his room, reading a book. Knock, knock, knock at the door. In burst Zadok, Nathan and Benaiah, with his mum Bathsheba in the background. "Quick, there's no time to lose. There's a rebellion underway. You're going to be crowned king, Solomon, right now." What do you mean now? I haven't cleaned my teeth. Hang on, I'll just find my shoes. He was propelled onto the throne in an instant. Just imagine the thoughts in the young man's mind. He knew he was going to be king one day, but what? Right now? And there's a bewildering turn of events. And he's rocketed onto the stage as king at breakneck speed. And as he's rocketed onto the throne, he's knowing that just down the hill, there's a full-blooded rebellion being hatched by a very dangerous group of people. So much for an orderly, planned succession to the throne. But we know that the preemptive strike was successful. The city rejoices with a great shout, and those that are clustered with Adonijah are suddenly dealing with a very different situation than the one which they had anticipated. And they're caught off guard. They've been completely wrong-footed by this, and they panic. Oops, I might be on the wrong side. And so they all run away. And I can imagine Joab and Abiathar gnashing their teeth in fury and rage, which would then very quickly turn to real apprehension, because the old man has outfoxed them. What an extraordinarily dramatic day in the history of Israel. You know, brothers and sisters, it's no wonder that Solomon felt a bit overwhelmed as he assumed the rulership of the people of Israel. And we'll pick up the flavour of that in our next study, God willing, in his prayers to God for help. But the really remarkable thing for us tonight is what those events did for his father. Because David, who had been languishing in his bed, described in the scriptures having the bedclothes heaped over him to try and keep him warm, conducting the affairs of state literally in his bedroom with people coming in to see him and him speaking heaped up from his bed, he suddenly galvanized into a man of action. And that elderly invalid is suddenly replaced by a dynamic and determined old man on a mission. So much to do, so little time. It would appear after this initial crowning that David and Solomon may have ruled together as co-regents for a period of time, probably, from the record, in the vicinity of about 12 months in total, the last of David's 40-year reign. It was in this time, in that last little period, that David changed the entire course, establishment, and arrangement of religious duties in the nation. And it carries on from this point here in chapter 23. In chapter 23, he sets out all the Levitical duties. He then changes the age of the priests from 30 to 20. In chapter 24, he sets out the 24 courses of the priests. In chapter 25, he appoints all the singers in their various companies. In chapter 26, he sets up the courses of the porters. He then, in chapter 26, sets up the Levites over the treasures of the house of God. He then establishes a religious judicial system. And the tribe of Levi is then distributed throughout the land, men for the outward business over Israel, princes and judges, as they're described in 26, verse 29. Then he appoints Levites, 1,700 on the west of the Jordan, 2,700 on the east of the Jordan, as officers in the business of Yahweh and in the service of the king, for every matter pertaining to God and the affairs of the king, in verse 30 to 32. An enormous burst of activity changing the judicial and religious government structures of the nation, all in that last period of time. Now we know that it's done in the last year of his life, because have a look at chapter 23, verse 27. "For by the last words of David, the Levites were numbered from 20 years old and above. Well, have a look at chapter 26 and verse 31. Among the Hebronites, Jerijah the chief, etc., etc., in the 40th year of the reign of David, they were sought for. So this is literally the very last year of his reign. And all these things are being described after Solomon was crowned in chapter 23 and verse 1. And most of these arrangements were for after the house had been built. So this is David looking forward to a different structure in the management of their kingdom after the house of God has been built. The overwhelming impression we get is of a man on a mission. He has 1 year left, and he's determined to ensure that the governance structures are put in place as robustly as they can be before he passes away. But there's still one more major thing which has to be done, and that takes place in chapter 28 and chapter 29. So let's turn now to 1 Chronicles and chapter 28. Because here, David calls together an enormous gathering of people. You could call it the Grand Assembly. Just look at who he pulls together. Verse 1, David assembled all the princes of Israel, the princes of the tribes, and the captains of the companies that ministered to the king by course, and the captains over thousands and captains over hundreds, and the stewards over all the substance and possession of the king and of his sons, with the officers and with the mighty men and with all the valiant men unto Jerusalem. Everybody who's anybody is brought to Jerusalem for this all-encompassing grand assembly for David to pass across his final instructions and the final charge. So he starts off by explaining to them the divine appointment of Solomon. He's giving them a message. Make sure that you submit to Solomon as your divinely appointed king. Then in verses 9 and 10, he turns to Solomon and he repeats the charge to serve God and to build the house. Then in verse 11, he gives to Solomon his son the pattern of the porch. In verse 12, it says it's the pattern of all that he had by the Spirit. Verse 19, all this said David, Yahweh made me understand in writing by his hand upon me, even all the works of this pattern. So there is a formal passing across to Solomon all the details for the structure of what that new house would be like. Not only the pattern of the house, but also the courses of the priests and the Levites. So a meticulous setting out of everything that Solomon needed to adhere to build this house of God. So what's being described here? What is this all about? What's going on in this particular record? All of these details of the house and the command to Solomon and the command for everybody else to get involved, what's happening here? This is the passing on of an intergenerational commitment to build the house of God. David wanted to complete building that house, but he was unable to do so. But his son could continue on to complete the work begun. So brothers and sisters and young people, as we sit here tonight, what's the message for us that comes from this story? Well, it's this. David knew that he was going to die. He was not going to be able to complete that task. You see, generations come and go with frightening speed. Man is like the flower of the field, which today is and tomorrow is gone. And the charge is passed on to each generation to work in the building of that house. Now, when Solomon arrived, he made use of all the materials that had been gathered In fact, not just by his father David, but you may want to note 1 Chronicles 26, verse 27 and 28. The record tells us that the gathering of materials went way back to the days of Samuel and those that followed after. All sorts of different people had contributed the materials that were going to be used in this house. In fact, multiple generations. The building of the house of God is the project that each of us is involved in today together. It's when everybody contributes all the materials and the wise master builder finally constructs the completed edifice, then truly the ark of God will be at rest and Yahweh will dwell among his people. So as we observe tonight an old man who is racing against the clock, passionately committed to gathering all the material he can to complete that work, gathering the silver and the gold and the timber in abundance, the same is happening in our ecclesias today all around the world. Generations come and go with great rapidity. And for the younger brothers and sisters that are in the hall here or tent here tonight, I remember when I was your age that there were great brothers of faith who acted as mentors to us and who encouraged us in the word. And where are they now? They've either fallen asleep or they've become so elderly that they are no longer able to be involved in leadership in ecclesial life. You see, generations come and go with great rapidity. And the question here, particularly for every young family, every young couple, every young person, is will you take on the charge to build the house of God? That's what this story is all about for us here tonight. The work of building the temple of God is a work that requires commitment and zeal and courage. Be strong and of good courage was David's advice to Solomon. At times in ecclesial life, it's daunting work. Fear not, nor be dismayed, said David. It has to be done the right way. Observe all the statutes and the commands was the instruction that David gave Solomon. Because if we do that, brothers and sisters and young people, he will be with us. He will never fail us, nor forsake us, until that work is finally complete. Because he will prosper the building of that house. But of course, the question for all of us here tonight is an individual question. Have we taken up that charge? And it's a question that all of us can only answer for ourselves, every brother, every sister that's here tonight. It's a charge that Solomon took up, and so the work was completed. You know, brothers and sisters, it's interesting. No previous generation has ever been able to finish that work. There's more to be done. I'd like you to come with me back to 1 Chronicles 22. And just look at the words of David once more. 1 Chronicles 22, verse 14, he says, "Now behold, in my trouble I have prepared for the house of Yahweh." The ESV says, "With great pains I have provided to the house of Yahweh." Young's Literal says, "In my affliction I have prepared." So just think of those brothers and sisters and young people who have gone before us. Look at the trouble they went to make sure that the work of building the house would continue on past their time and into ours. And then look at the enthusiasm. David says, look, I've built 100,000 talents of gold. I've gathered 1,000. These are enormous numbers. 100,000 talents of gold. 1,000 talents of silver. Brass and iron without weight. It's all in abundance. Timber and stone have I prepared. What would you think? Well, he doesn't need my little offering, does he? But look what he says at the end of the verse. And thou mayest add thereto. Now, brothers and sisters and young people, is that not a message to us personally? Yes, there's been a gathering of all these materials down through the ages, but you can add to it, is the message of the divine record. It's a message to each of us, brothers and sisters, that the work of gathering the material for that house is not finished until the mighty builder comes and puts every stone into its place and the edifice is complete. And David looked at it and he said, this house has to be magnificent because the palace... Let's have a look at it. Chapter 29 and verse 1. He said, furthermore, David the king said unto all the congregation, Solomon is young and tender, the work is great. This palace is not for man, but for Yahweh Elohim. And so, brothers and sisters and young people, we continue on the work that has been begun. It is our personal responsibility to take up that charge and to continue the work of gathering the material so that when the greater than Solomon arises and brings all the materials together, every stone will have its place and there will be no lack. And the message of this record for us tonight, brothers and sisters, is that an enormous gathering has been taking place down through the ages, but you may add to it as well. So may it be that we faithfully take up the charge, that we might be strong and of good courage to observe Yahweh's commandments in that work, that what we do might prosper. For we know, brothers and sisters, that he will never fail us nor forsake us until that work is complete.